Hello.
Hello.
And welcome to the 10th episode of Season to Taste. For new listeners,
switch off now.
We should explain that basically we're watching one story from each season of Doctor Who.
The 34 active years of Doctor Who?
The 35 active years of Doctor Who. So, basically the 26 classic series, the Paul McGann movie, and then each of the years since, that in some cases we've arbitrarily assigned Christmas specials and tenant specials. So this is episode 10, which means we've just done our 9th story, which was Ghost Light from season 26. And Matthew, what did you think of Ghost Light?
In general, I think it's very good. I like the spooky atmosphere of it. I like the conceit of it being very much about evolution, and I like a lot of the acting in it. I think it has some quite major flaws, but I don't think that should detract from the fact that it is a very striking and original story, and another really strong one for season 26.
Yeah, it's very different from any other story, really, which is nice. But I'm not sure it really achieves what it sets out to achieve. And to be honest, I'm not really sure what it sets out to achieve either. It has a lot of, as you say, it has a lot of atmosphere to it and a strong sense of style. When I first watched it, I thought I understood it, and I was just slightly amused by people who said they couldn't follow it. Whereas watching it again now, actually, I don't think I really follow it at all. I understand that it's trying to make some points and that vaguely who the characters are, but I don't really understand how Josiah Samuel Smith fits in with Light, you know, the idea of being a personification of the survey and things like that. They're very confusing, and there's lots of characters like the Reverend who don't really appear to take an active part in the story.
Well, I suppose, so you put your finger on one thing that confuses me about it, and there are a number of things that I think are bizarre and unexplained and done for effect rather than any plot logic. So Redver's box of light in the first episode is never explained, and it doesn't seem to have any reason to be there.
No, and even Redver's himself is in it tied to the assassinating Queen Victoria plot. Quite really what that's got to do with anything. It's an extra confusion and almost a way to try and tie it into the Victorian era, but it doesn't matter at all.
Well, I think this is one of those things where you kind of need to read the DWM archive or something like that to really understand what Mark Platt's trying to do. So I believe the whole Crown Saxe-Coburg thing is that Josiah believes that the pinnacle of evolution is the most powerful creature on the planet.
The Empress
and
of
therefore
India.
The Empress of Great Britain, of India, and the Queen of Great Britain is therefore the most evolved creature in the planet. And you kind of get that sense that Josiah's wanting to evolve into a Victorian gentleman. The Doctor makes that comment, and Control's very much focused on wanting to become a ladylike. So it's kind of trying to use the progression of humankind from the kind of caveman represented by Nimrod to Queen Victoria as the gamut of evolution in the late 19th century. I'm not sure that really comes across if you haven't read the DWM archive. I don't think you really get that from the story.
But why, and so what, he wants to assassinate her so he can take her place and be as evolved as possible?
Well, quite, so how does that even work? Because then Edward VII obviously becomes here.
Yeah.
The other thing is, what confuses me, the DWM archive picks up on your point about Josiah being the survey and points out, well, Control sits in a locked room on the spaceship. She's meant to be the experiment Control, and Josiah Samuel Smith is supposed to go around the planet and change into all of the different creatures on the planet so that Light can catalogue
right things.
But it kind of suggests Light doesn't seem to know anything about evolution. And if he didn't, or he didn't think that was important, why would he need a Control? I don't really... Surely a Control to an experiment is to chess change and to understand the concept.
Well, I assume it means to a control, as in this is the kind of species that Josiah normally is, and so as he changes into each other's species, we need to
catalogue the differences.
I mean, what I don't get about it is I don't really understand why Light wants to catalogue everything in the first place, and the implication is that Light goes around cataloguing planets, plural, and is having trouble now that he's discovered evolution on Earth. Except there's no reason, even though the Doctor says, or, you know, typical Earth, everything evolving, it won't stand still. But that would happen on any planet. The whole point of evolution isn't that it's an Earth-based thing. It is how life develops. So if light's gone to any other planets, there would be evolution there as well.
Yeah, thank goodness he never went to Pterodon.
Yeah, so I don't. It doesn't make a lot of sense, and it doesn't. Given that light, you know, light's been asleep a long time, and so is disappointed that everything's out of date. But even when he's woken up, he immediately recognises that things are evolving in front of him, which surely he would have recognised then. Originally, when they were happening, it's very stylistic, and the ideas are there. And you know, Reverend Matthews is only in it to get turned into a chimp at the expense of his own Christian disbelief in evolution.
Yeah, so I agree. I think that stylishness is what makes it interesting to watch. I think it is. For all that we've criticised the plot logic, and I don't think it stands up to scrutiny, I do think it's a very stylish and interesting story to watch. There's loads of things going on there, and the cast that's been assembled for it is really, really very strong.
Well, you've got John Nettleton from Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister. He's very good as the Reverend. You've got Frank Windsor, Sylvia Sims?
Yeah.
Ian Hogg's very good. I like John Hallam, but I'm not quite sure about the way light is performed. I don't know, it seems a bit overly childish at times. I don't know, he has like sinister moments, but it seems, at the end of the day, it's a man in a funny cape.
Yeah. So, I think it's, as a story, I think the emphasis is very much on spectacle, on things going on making it interesting to watch, rather than it actually having to make, you know, a lot of logical sense. And, you know, I can kind of buy into that. I wouldn't want that to be the way the series always was, but for 3 weeks, I'm sure it was one of the most interesting and intriguing things on television. I'm sure people watched it and kind of wondered, what on earth does all of this mean? And it made them think, it might have prompted them, yeah, to...
I picture a casual audience watching it, and particularly watching the last episode, and going, no, I just don't know what's going on.
Well, I don't think a casual audience would notice. I think they'd just
Doctor Who. As much as there was a casual audience, yeah, for Doctor Who in 1989.
Well, quite. I think a casual audience might just think, oh, well, it's Doctor Who being its normal, strange self. I think either an audience commits to it and pays attention and tries to interpret it, or they're casual and they just want to watch a string of interest. Images on
My problem with it is I don't actually think it well rewards that paying of attention, because I think you still get to the end and go, I don't really understand what was going on.
I sort of agree with that. I think it's one of those stories where it makes you want to understand it, and it challenges you to have a think, and you might come up on some points and think, well, it doesn't make sense, I don't really understand what Mark Platt was trying to get at.
Yeah.
Or alternatively, I don't think the way that this has been directed or made helps to articulate that point. So a particular scene I'm thinking of in question is the cliffhanger in episode 1, where it's Control talking, but the camera's focusing on Josiah's husks. So actually, at the end of episode 1, if it's the first time you've watched it, you'd naturally think it's those two husks talking. And it becomes very, very weird and very difficult, I think, to follow what Mark Platt's intent is, yeah, at points.
I think, I mean, I actually like the direction on the whole. I think there's some really nice ideas, and given it is a kind of cramped studio set, some of the things they managed to do, point of view shots, some of the handheld stuff is really nice. What you're saying about thinking about the story and the kind of reward you might get doing that, I know you said when we were watching it about Mark Platt writing it, and we talked about evolution as a theme a lot, but actually a kind of 80s Thatcherism, mm-hmm, as a theme, and the Victorian values being an analogy for Thatcherite values and that kind of Thatcherite social values, and the desire to be like have status in
absolutely
society.
I think the whole thing is incredibly 1980s. I think the way it's made feels like a kind of experimental Derek Jarman type film from the 1980s. And I definitely think Josiah Samuel Smith is a proto Thatcherite. He talks about in the final episode reinvigorating the British Empire and being dynamic, all of the kind of things that Thatcher was about. And it's strange that Thatcherism's that bizarre balance between the deadening forces of conservatism and not wanting to change, and a woman who wanted to really strip down the order of Britain and change it to...
Yes, and that's what that's also what we said, wasn't it? That Light's thing about not having anything change is a very, very traditional Tory or conservative, somewhat conservative position.
But I think the whole story to me defies a simple... It's not a parable or an allegory. It doesn't have a simple way to decode it. I think there's lots and lots of things going on there. You can read lots of different things into it. You can read Ace's kind of awakening into it. There's loads of different things that you can project onto the story.
Those last two stories, and even Ghostlight, even as in the last two produced stories, and Ghostlight even more than Survival, Ace very much seems grown up. And partly it's that, outfit that she wears at the very beginning is actually a very grown up outfit, because she doesn't wear her bomber jacket, and it's very much a kind of young woman outfit and not a teenager outfit. There is a kind of matureness about her that you get that you haven't necessarily had before, and it's there a bit in Survival as well, but it's, I think it's more pronounced in Ghostlight.
I think that Ace is written very differently and played very differently there than in Silver Nemesis, which is the last McCoy story that we watched for the podcast. In Silver Nemesis, she's a kind of happy-go-lucky teenager. In this one, I absolutely agree. She's a young woman, and she has a different relationship with the Doctor. He's clearly trying to develop her into something. So it's interesting that there's even in Ghostlight, you can link the theme of the Doctor's trying to evolve Ace into something. Mm. He's giving her initiative tests. He wants to change Ace. He wants to delve into her dark fears.
He wants to end her fear, basically, doesn't he?
Yeah, but he wants to change, you know, he wants to change what she is, in a sense. And I think that's quite interesting, and you can read that into it as well.
And although Control is the Eliza Doolittle character in the story, the Doctor does call Ace Eliza earlier on, as if he is Professor Higgins-ing her. He's actually trying to move her in, but not to a society woman, but to, you know, the super companion or whatever role he has planned that you never then follow up, sadly. As well as, the Eliza Doolittle reference is just one of the many, many almost over-the-top Victorian references and literature references and idioms that are scattered through. At times it's nice, but I think the story slightly bends under the weight of the sheer number of lines scattered through it that reference, you know, there's references to Dracula is specifically mentioned, but then separately you have Control eating the bug, which is very Dracula as well. Yeah, you've got two separate references to Pygmalion. You've got Reading Jail mentioned, which is obviously a reference to Oscar Wilde. It almost feels like it's trying too hard to...
I think it adds a lot of texture to the story. I think, for me, I get very challenged by the logic of it, because I have a very logical mind, and I find Ghostlight in some ways intensely frustrating, because it kind of defies a logical reading. But I think part of that might be that it's been too heavily cut, as were many Andrew Cartmell edited stories. It feels like they haven't quite got the right amount of plot and story for the runtime.
Yeah, it's odd. It doesn't. In a way, it feels like it doesn't have enough story, and yet you think maybe if it was four episodes long, there would be a bit more scope to have a clearer narrative, because you wouldn't be trying to squeeze so much in.
I agree. So I think that maybe the production of it, as I've said, makes it suffer a little bit. But even if that wasn't the case, I do think that it's deliberately elusive. I think it's deliberately difficult to read. It was obviously a story that evolved from Lungbarrow, as it originally was, and that would have been basically Mark Platt doing Gormenghast. The line Ghostlight is mentioned, I think, early on in the book, Gormenghast, as a description. And I think Gormenghast is a very strange, elusive book by Mervyn Peake. And if you have in the back of your mind that Mark Platt was originally inspired by this weird book that creates its own bizarre world with its own little rules and its own strange terms and...
Going to Java.
Absolutely. If you go at it from that perspective, I think you can kind of see why the story is as it is.
Those idioms and things, there's a real similarity, I think, to Paradise Towers, both in the idea of, it's not slang the way they use it, they use Java as a euphemism, but it's similar to some of the slang, like taken to the cleaners, that you get in Paradise Towers. But also the way the control speaks, I think, is quite like the Kangs, that kind of, in Paradise Towers, it's kind of English is devolved a bit because of the circumstances, whereas in Control's case is that she hasn't had the education and she's pulling the words together, and you get that kind of thing where she's a cross between Eliza Doolittle but also a bit of Gollum. But yeah, I think there's a real similarity, and I don't know if that's a Cartmel-affected thing, of the Kangs in Paradise Towers and the language in Ghostlight.
I think it could be. I do think it's great that even in the very last show of the classic run, Doctor Who's still provoking people to have these kind of discussions and to try and, you know, analyse something that's really textually dense. I think
the semiotic thickness.
Sorry, that does sound pompous, but I think it's great that Doctor Who's still producing stuff that's as challenging, maybe as something like Warrior's Gate or Kinder, something that's...
It's odd you mentioned Kinder, because right at the beginning, all the stuff about Redford's Ben Cooper and searching for himself and his madness really reminded me of Hindle in Kinder. Kinder is the only story that really deals with madness properly. There's a touch of it in The Talents of Wong Chang, but it's, you know, it isn't what Redford's story is. That's kind of wrapped up in his first few appearances in Ghostlight, which is a shame, because it feels like for a moment they're actually going to tackle his madness, but then don't. But they, you know, it is still an issue. It's still brought up, and it did remind me of Kinder. It's actually the story itself is very self-referential for Doctor Who, not in a way that I think burdens it. But yeah, his mind is snapped. His mind is broken. He's in Talons. At least two other references to Talons. The Doctor refers to Ace as the noble savage. He asks Redvers if it's a Chinese firing piece. You do kind of feel that someone particularly likes The Talons of the other Victorian story.
I think that Sylvester McCoy's Doctor is written very much like Tom Baker's Doctor in that story as well, striding in, making kind of funny little jokey comments, kind of trying to take control of the situation, saying, oh, what's going on over there? That looks quite interesting. I do think Mark Platt's obviously very much a fan of Tom Baker, and I think you get that very much in the story. I think Sylvester McCoy rises to the occasion. I think with one groan-worthy exception.
What is happening in that bit where he's holding out his fist and gurning at light? I don't even understand why he's doing it.
It's a very misjudged moment, an otherwise really good performance.
Yeah, he's great all the way through, and there's some lovely... I mean, the scene where Ace finds out it's Gabriel Chase, and then he's talking to her about the famous bit about lost luggage and lost souls and all that, it's glorious. I mean, it's really, really beautiful. And then you just get that with that scene where you go, I don't even understand what you're trying to do, let alone how you're doing it. it's a show made very quickly, and every Doctor, you know, however good, they have their moments of where you slightly cringe and go, yeah, that's probably not the decision.
Davison?
Possibly except Davison. I can't point to one. Maybe not Troughton either, but...
Yeah, Troughton and Davison, probably not. But yeah, I kind of agree in general. Yeah.
Even like, you know, I love Tennant, but there are times where I go, just tone it down.
Yeah.
I mean, there are more references as well. I wondered whether it's a good joke in its own right, so it might not be deliberate, but certainly the Cream of Scotland Yard is basically the same joke as the Toast of Little Hodcombe. And of course, the biggest piece of self-referentialism is probably the Doctor casually quoting The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So the Doctor has read a book written by someone who wrote Doctor Who. That's quite confusing. When he says Earthmen don't invite their ancestors around to dinner, that is out of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
But I think that's the perfect summation of Ghostlight, isn't it? It's a story which delights in its own self-referential nature. It delights in the literary references that it makes, and I think to an audience there's two ways that you could react. You can either be turned off by the fact that it gets so involved in creating its own little world that actually plot logic seems to go out the window, or you can go with it and you can enjoy the fact that it's not quite like any other Doctor Who story and not quite like any other television that's ever been made.
No, absolutely. And other things I enjoyed about it, I love that in that very first opening scenes around the house, and particularly in the lobby, I did suddenly go, isn't this the house from Dark Shadows? And the Reverend contributed to that as well, because he looks at and feels a lot like Reverend Trask in Dark Shadows. And the big staircase and the wooden panels and the creepy house generally and the photographic stills of the outside of the house all feel a lot like Dark Shadows, which...
Are you getting paid for the number of times that you can mention Dark Shadows in this podcast?
I'm not, actually, although I think it probably is worth mentioning that one of the reasons there was a delay before the last episode went online is because I was working on my Dark Shadows audio currently slated for July, and you can pre-order it on the Big Finish website now.
Thanks, Will. That sounds really interesting.
Anyway, what else did I like? I like that that's the way to the zoo song, as well as being a kind of bit of fun music hall-esque Victoriana. The whole idea of the monkey house actually ties in with the Reverend and with evolution. I thought the creepy crawlers were genuinely creepy, when they're all coming alive. I love that line that Redvers has just casually about control, where he says, "Of course, if she was a real lady, I wouldn't be in her boudoir."
That is a brilliant. That did make me laugh out loud when he said it. It's an excellent line.
I think there's a point which, even though it actually crosses a line and they probably shouldn't have done it, Light's just holding the maid's arm, saying, "I wanted to know how it worked, so I dismantled it."
Oh, that's a fantastic moment of horror.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably a bit too far for Doctor Who, particularly with the bloodied stump of the arm, but it is a hilarious little moment. Yeah, I also love Josiah. We talk about Josiah's position and his wanting to have an elevated position.
Yeah.
But even as the whole of his plot is decaying and Light's come back and everything else, he still organises to have dinner on the dot and is annoyed when people he isn't happy at his dinner table are there. He's standing looking at his watch, waiting for dinner to start.
And Nimrod says something like, "Excuse me, sir, but the apocalypse of Earth was started sometime prior to dinner."
defining the fact that the self-destruct or whatever it is in the ship is based on dinner time. I thought, we said about the cast, but I thought Ian Hogg's performance of Josiah Semismith is really good, and his way of walking, that kind of zombie-ish way of walking, is not too much, but he kind of lumbers like as if he's quite in control of the body.
Like he's a creature inhabiting the body rather than a human being.
Yeah. And yeah, these just wonderfully creative ideas. Just pulling open a drawer and having a policeman lying in there is just mad. I'm slightly disappointed that Gwendolyn doesn't say the menagerie is almost complete. We don't ever find out really what the relevance of Ace is. You know, the Doctor spends the whole story saying to Ace, "What was it you felt?" And it doesn't really ever come to much. Except right at the end, when he talks about, an evil older than time. And he can't be talking about Light, because Light isn't evil. And you suddenly think, is this tied to Fenric? Is this tied to Ace's Wolves of Fenric story?
Mm. I think the whole season is about purging Ace's childhood fears, isn't it, and helping her to confront them. So in the next story, he takes her to face her mother, who she has issues with, and then in the story after that, he actually takes her back to Perivale, and kind of gets her to confront her, what she's been running from for so long. So I think it very much ties to that theme.
And you know, and the end of that is her deciding that home is the TARDIS, it isn't Perivale, actually. She's over it, really. Yeah. Now, I think as a narratively, Ghostlight is quite weak, but as a piece of Doctor Who, it's really quite interesting and inventive, and I'm certainly very glad that it exists, and it makes for perfectly entertaining three episodes.
I think Series 26, as we said last time, is one of the absolute strongest ever, old run and new run, and I think it's one of the rare seasons where every story improves on its predecessor. So I think Ghostlight is better than Battlefield. I think it's a more assured and interesting piece of work. I think the next two stories, Fenric and particularly Survival, are among the very best that Doctor Who has ever been. So I think, you know, Doctor Who went out absolutely on a high.
Yeah, it went out on a high. It was a shame that in terms of kind of viewing figures, it was going out on a low, because actually that it was getting good again, and after kind of the problems of season 23 and 24, actually the turmoil had kind of settled down. You had a good script editor in place, the series actually knew what it wanted to do and where it was going and had a plan. You had the most watchable leads that you've had in a very long time.
Oh, since 1979.
And some great stories. And, you know, we don't know that, you know, season 27 might have been rubbish and carried on, but we can at least be glad that those last two series are actually really good in it. And it's a shame more people didn't get to see them.
Yeah. Well, the Lost Stories season 27 has got some of the stories that were vaguely mooted, I think, for the 1990 series. But
you can't judge anything.
No, but I think, you know, they were in such early stages of production or even development that I think they were pretty much written just as new stories for Big Finish from a vague idea. So, yeah, you can't get any sense from them of what 1990 would have been like.
Okay, so we have done now two of Celeste McCoy's three seasons. We still haven't had the First Doctor, we still haven't had the Fourth Doctor, the Fifth Doctor, or the Tenth Doctor. So, let's find out where we're going to go next. As usual, we will ask the randomizer to pick a season for us, and then we will decide between us which story from that season we will taste. So, randomizer, which season will it be? Great.
I don't like the sound of this.
No, it's absolutely fine, and it's quite fitting in a way. We're still not going to go to the First Doctor, or the Fourth Doctor, or the Fifth Doctor, or the Tenth Doctor, because the randomizer has told us that we should actually complete Sylvester McCoy and go into season 24.
Okay.
So once again, there are but four stories from which to choose. Time in the Rani, Paradise Towers that we were just talking about, Delta and the Bannermen, and Dragonfire. Now, I actually pondered earlier in the week. I was thinking, if season 24 came up, which story would it be? So I have an idea in my head of which one I would go for. So do you want to kick off?
Yeah, I also have a very clear idea of the story that I would go for. It wouldn't be Time in the Rani, which, although it has its charms, and I actually quite enjoy it in a perverse way.
A story, though, where the best moment of the story is in the pre-title sequence. Is it pre-titles in Time?
Leave the Girl, it's the Man I Want. Yes, it is pre-titles. And just before Sylvester McCoy's wig falls off. I do like Delta and the Bannermen. It's kind of things starting to come together. It's got this lovely summery feel. Slightly stymied by the fact that it does look like it was made to be broadcast at about 4:30 on Children's BBC.
I've got to say, it looks like a Children's BBC show.
I think Dragonfire's fun and obviously introduces Ace, so there's quite a few nice things about it. But the one that I would really most like to watch is Paradise Towers, because I think that it almost immediately nails what needs to change about Doctor Who to get it out of the rut that it had been in over the last couple of years, and sets about fixing it in a very compelling way. I'm quite excited about Paradise Towers.
It wasn't the one I was going to suggest. As with seasons 25 and 26, to be honest, I'm pretty relaxed. Not so much because they're all brilliant, but there's only one that I think is actually pretty bad, which is Time of the Rani. And that's the one I haven't seen anywhere near as much as the others, and the one I therefore am most curious about, but I have no intention of opting for, because I'd rather go with one of the better ones. Paradise Towers is probably the one I've seen the most, and also the most recently. It does have that classic Richard Pryor's performance. It would be interesting to compare it again with what we were just saying about the language in Ghostlight. Yeah. That would be quite interesting to look at. Delta was actually the one I had in my head, because it's one that people have quite a lot of affection for, despite its drawbacks. And it's one I've only seen, I think, a couple of times. And so, even though in my head it does look like an old episode of Uncle Jack or something, I'm kind of interested in that. Dragonfire, I've seen loads. It was one of the ones I had on video years ago, and my brother and I would watch and knew it quite well. There's a lot I like about Dragonfire. I think it would be quite fitting to complete the Ace set by watching Dragonfire as well. And obviously Mel is in all four of them anyway, so we get Mel and the Seventh Doctor, whichever we choose. Delta would be interesting to look at that relationship with Ray, the other possible companion. But I am, if you want to go with Paradise Towers, I'm fairly relaxed about it. I'd rather do one of the other two. But I kind of see your point about it's where Cartmel's influence is properly coming in, and that kind of, they're very high concept, the Seventh Doctor era stories, and it's the first of them, and it's, you know, yes, it's nicked from, or it's influenced by, is it, it's High Rising by
J.G. Ballard.
It's taking an idea and then building something around it, which actually you do get in, that's what you get in The Happiness Patrol, that's what you get in Greater Show in the Galaxy, yeah. It's what you get in Ghostlight. So yeah, I'm quite happy to go with that, but I know it quite well, but it is interesting, and it is very much an example of the way they create a world.
Yeah, I think the good thing is we are debating what are the two Head and Shoulders best stories of the season in Paradise Towers and Delta and the Banimer.
You know, I actually don't think there's that much difference between those two and Dragonfire. I don't think any of them is brilliant, and I don't think any of them is particularly bad. They all have strengths and weaknesses, and you know, yeah. Glitz is fun, which helps Dragonfire, even though the plot's a bit silly. And Kane's good, and Bellage is good, and
obviously Sophie Aldred gets introduced.
Yeah, whereas Delta, actually, I don't think the character's all that great, and it's more the fun of it and some of the ideas.
I don't mind watching Delta and the Bannermen. I think it's far more lightweight than Paradise Towers and far more disposable. It has got Sylvester McCoy's first great scene as the Doctor, and it's also got probably Bonnie Langford's best performance on TV, so there's things to like about Delta. I think it's a less interesting piece of work than Paradise Towers.
Well, usually I say, obviously we shouldn't just go for the one that's best, but I think Paradise Towers is more interesting and is trying to do something more interesting than any of the others. So maybe just on that basis, it'll be more interesting to talk about as well. And as you say, more of an example of the direction of the series. Is it 4? It's 4433, isn't it? So it's also an episode longer.
Yeah.
Well, we'll not take that into account. I love this idea that we're doing it because we love Doctor Who while at the same time trying to avoid watching too much Doctor Who. Yeah, let's not be cowardly cutlets. Let's go for Paradise Towers for exactly the reasons we've said, and come back next time and find out what we thought of that.
Blue Kang Leader Unalive.
I don't know what that means.
The Kangs, the red, the blue and the yellow Kangs.
Yeah. Blue Kang
representing the three major political parties.
Oh, I see, you're saying because Helen A died earlier in the week. It's good. I mean, bear in mind, that's a reference Matt's made to Margaret Thatcher dying this week, but I don't know whether I'm going to put this online, so I mean, when I finally edit this in 2 months' time, it might not be topical at all. Blue Rinse Leader on a line. Anyway, thank you for listening. I've been Will, he's been Matthew. See you next time. Bye.
Bye.
I'll cut that. I'll cut that bit in as the bit after the end that's like an outtake.
Oh, okay.